getting hitched.
Erase your memory and listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies no one else wants to talk about. This is episode number 84, and my name's Arthur.
My name's Nick.
And my name's Randy.
Alrighty then, now, thanks for listening, thanks for tuning in, downloading, whatever it is you people do, wherever you are, thank you very much for supporting us with your ears. I'm high, I'm sorry. Anyway... Today, oh, I mean, no. I don't know, I feel like I'm a little bit high because, you know, today August is coming to a close. It's going to be cashing in its chips, collecting its paycheck, so to speak. I have nothing written down for this, by the way. This is coming straight from here.
Yes!
Okay. This is like this. Anyway, before we do this, I don't know, you read the title, you know that we're doing Paycheck, which I think, yeah, to this day, this is the last film John Woo did in Hollywood. I'm not sure if Manhunt is a Hollywood film.
Manhunt isn't an Hollywood film, but he's coming back. He came back. He's in post-production with a new project, so you know.
There it is. So, for now, this is the last one that he did. Paycheck in 2003. What am I talking about? Anyway, but before we do this, standard plug, before we do anything, just a quick recap. The full complement of August episodes of our bonus tie-in series, retrospectives, and the David Lynch marathon are available on our Patreon, patreon.com/uncutgemspod, just in case you forgot. So, as a bonus tie-in, we did Hard Boiled, and as a retrospective, the boys did JCVD plus Hong Kong retrospective, where they talked about Maximum Risk, Double Team, and Knock Off. So, three classics, okay?
Amen, brother.
So here, no different. This is great. And then, of course, we did a conversation about Lost Highway and premature ejaculation, I suppose. This is just so tune in. This is great. Like, and strangling your saxophone is now in an innuendo that I shall use.
Together with punching the snake.
Together with punching the snake and my daily sort of operations until I get fired from somewhere. Anyway, so I might as well just at this point. I think it's a good point to also mention that on Patreon in September what we're going to do so that you can just get yourselves ready for this. Because September's theme for the Patreon operations is kind of neo-noir / Elmore Leonard. Let's just say appreciation. Because we're tying this into two episodes we'll be doing towards the end of the month. On the regular show we'll be talking about 52 Pickup and Out of Sight. And that's because this is a collab yet again with Death by Adaptation. I might as well just say this, because on Death by Adaptation, there's going to be a special episode. I'll be guesting on this because, like, this is one of my favorite films. So why the hell not? We'll be talking about Jackie Brown. So that's an Elmore Leonard adaptation. And then we're going to be talking about 52 Pickup and Out of Sight, which are all Elmore Leonard adaptations. And then as a bonus tie-in to this, we're going to be talking about Hombre, 1967 Hombre starring Paul Newman, which is also an Elmore Leonard adaptation. And then as a retrospective, I think we'll be talking about, because we're doing a retrospective this month. Like this has been decided. We're doing one, because why not? We're not going to be doing a three Elmore Leonard adaptations, but we're going to be doing a next best thing, which is talking about three noir films directed by the Coen brothers. Some may be more well-known, some a little bit less. So there's going to be a conversation about Blood Simple, Miller's Crossing, and The Man Who Wasn't There. So stay tuned for this. And of course, David Lynch continues as well with Straight Story in September. So $3 a month will give you quite a lot of content to listen to in exchange for our unwavering and unending gratitude for supporting our little show and making sure that you know, the lights keep staying on. And then if you don't know, you know, like, prices of energy are skyrocketing. So might as well go and subscribe. Anyway. To keep these, because, you know, I'm in the dark already. Also,
oh, it's dark.
Also, a week from now, 9th of September, if you live in Charlottetown or on Prince Edward Island in Canada, or in the vicinity of, I don't know, Canadian distances are weird, because it, for me, in the vicinity of Prince Edward Island is essentially in a different country. because it's like it's a 4-hour drive. Like, yeah, and if I drive for 4 hours, I'll be in the ocean. I mean, this is not. anyway, Randy's gonna be on site in a collaboration with Classics at City Cinema. There's gonna be a screening of Freebie and the Bean starring James Caan, and this is a screening in commemoration of James Caan's memory, right? Because he passed away not so long ago, and that's why this is happening. So Randy's gonna be there. He's gonna have some swag to dish out from in exchange for a few things. Woo-hoo! I don't know. Yep. Do you want to just say a few words on this, or do you want to just tease the people a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Like, so what we're going to do is we're going to have this screening, as Jakob said. If you're in the Charlottetown area, you know, and you're interested in buddy cop movies, and a couple of the first ones, Freebie and the Bean is one that sort of predates Lethal Weapon. It was Stanley Kubrick's favorite film of 1974. Tarantino is also a huge champion of the film. And yeah, it should be a fun screening. It's not one that I have really seen before, and I'm looking forward to it. We're going to launch episode 85 the same day as that screening. So if you attend the screening in Charlottetown, and if you listen to the podcast, touch base with us, and your name will go into a hat. We're going to have a draw for some t-shirts.
Yeah, fabulous. So, you know, stuff's happening.
Yeah.
So make sure you, I don't know, rent a car and drive to Charlottetown if you're in the area. If you're not in the area, just fly in and then just buy a ticket. Watch Freebie and the Bean on the big screen as it was intended to be seen. I suppose, I'm not sure if this is going to be a 35mm projection. I think it's a Blu-ray projection, right?
This would be a Blu-ray projection,
Okay, I suppose Tarantino's not showing up for this.
I'm not expecting him. In fact, I have the Blu-ray with me.
Oh, goodness.
Right here.
Yeah, so there's that. So stay tuned for this. And then I think at this point, might as well just proceed with the episode. So we're cashing in our paycheck on the Awuga series by talking about paychecks. So there we go.
Just sign there.
All right.
Great. Your personal items?
Yes.
You only needed 4 stamps.
Oh, well, guess I could afford the extra 50 cents. I don't think this is my stuff.
It's not?
No.
I don't know what happened.
It's all right. Don't worry about it. Doesn't matter. Let's talk about my shares. What I'd like to do is get some money now, and you know, put the rest away for long term, and you know, to live off. So how do we do that?
Mr. Jennings, you forfeited your shares.
I beg your pardon? What?
So paycheck again, directed by John Woo, because why not? Because that's what we're doing here, right? Yep. Stars Ben Affleck, Uma Thurman, Aaron Eckhart, Paul Giamatti, I'm forgetting someone, and a bunch of other people. And it's a story about an engineer who has his memory erased after completing a highly sensitive contract job with a mysterious corporation, and then also adapted from a Philip K. Dick novel, by the way, short story. And when he goes to collect his paycheck, sick, you know, lol, as in sick, as in S-I-C, exclamation mark, he finds out that he had his past self, before having his memory erased, forfeited this sort of exorbitant sum of money that he was promised in lieu of an envelope full of trinkets. And then soon, he realizes that the trinkets not only have a meaning, but also they're highly specific uses, which leads him to kind of figure out, okay, well, I'm going to need to go on a quest down this rabbit hole and figure out what these trinkets do, and then kind of puts his life at risk as a result. And then, of course, he just scratches at a conspiracy. And the story goes from there. Anyway, so the story was kind of just in development since like the mid-90s, I want to say. It was optioned in 1996, and I think Brett Ratner was attached for a while. It was supposed to be his directorial film, and then he kind of took a break and decided to do something else. Matt Damon was at some point attached to it. And then, I mean, he was offered the role of Michael Jennings, the main character, and he turned it down because it kind of looked to him, it's like, hold on, this looks like Bourne Identity all over again, and I don't want to get pigeonholed.
I've seen this before.
I've seen this before. And then he proceeded to do two more Bourne Identity films, because why the hell not? Anyway. So John Woo reluctantly apparently took the film. He wanted to make it a bit of a Hitchcock-style suspenseful thriller, but the script wasn't written that way. And so it was, of course, it's a science fiction film. So apparently, if anyone fishes out similarities to North by Northwest, it's correct. The John Woo approved similarities, because he put them there. He wanted that. So Ben Affleck was given his biggest paycheck with this, by the way, $50 million. It was a critical disaster. I think he got a Razzie for this. It stands at like 27% on Rotten Tomatoes, but it made money. I think it's just it's a feature in John Woo's career in Hollywood. Just critical bombs, but still makes money. So what is 117 on $60 million budget? Anyway, so apparently criticism was aimed mainly at Woo for reducing an intriguing story into a string of shootouts and chases. Like, what the hell did you expect? Anyway, so yeah, that's how the film kind of stands. And since then, it was largely, I want to say, forgotten. It's kind of one of those bad films that people don't want to touch when a 10-foot pole. So let's just bring out our 10-foot pole and then poke at it. So, boys, what do you think about Paycheck? Wants to go first.
Me, I do. I saw this in theaters, and basically I thought it was a dud, and I didn't think of it since. And then a few days ago, I watched it, and I thought, oh God, this is a bit of a dud. But I was really tired, and I thought, no, damn it, for these episodes, I want to give it an honest shake. So I'll watch it again, I decided. So all through the day yesterday, I was sort of drifting my consciousness in and out of thinking about Paycheck. And like, our conversations this month have been really interesting to me, and the conversations have sort of enriched sort of my understanding of Woo and his time in Hollywood. And so I kept thinking, just based on what we've talked about, what on earth would Woo see in this? And then it sort of dawned on me, and Jakob, you
paycheck.
Said it. It's not just the paycheck though, but this totally smells like a mistaken identity type of thing that Hitchcock would do. And you just mentioned it. It's like, oh, I see, because, you know, see these conversations we've had the last few weeks where we're saying, oh, this is Woo. He just wants to do a Western. Oh, this is Woo. He wants to do a John Wayne war film. So I'm thinking, yeah, this is John Woo, and he just wants to do a Hitchcock film. It totally makes sense. He went to Hollywood so he could make Hollywood movies, in a way. He's bringing his style to Hollywood.
It's like Tommy Wiseau. Go to Hollywood, make big Hollywood movie.
Yeah, wow. I hesitate to make that jump, but...
that's a stretch.
So...
he's like Tommy Wiseau.
They both come from the East.
That'll be in the hot takes. So when I watched it again last night with this perspective, yeah, this made it a little bit more interesting a view. And it's watching it from this perspective that Woo is trying to make a suspense film. I can see a lot more of that intent in here, like right down to, you know, Ben Affleck's costuming and that boring little apartment or room that he rents out. It totally looks like a 1950s room, for instance. So I appreciate this, and I sort of admire it a lot more, but it still has major issues. Like, I'm not going to lie. I'm sort of on the fence. I admire it. I'm not sure if I like it. The characters and the performances here, I think, very weak. You know, Affleck and Thurman, I don't know what they're doing. Eckhart, I used to like Aaron Eckhart, but now the last two films that I've seen of his, this and Black Dahlia, you know, I don't wonder why. Yeah, I got to go watch him in some Neil LaBute films or something. But
when did he do Thank You for Smoking?
2005.
Is that
That's
five?
A good one. I liked it.
I think in the Company of Man, there wasn't one with Helena Bonham Carter that I quite liked. Don't you remember the name, though?
Yeah, he has.
Conversations
he has
with Strangers, maybe, I think.
I like them. Mm-hmm. That's him and Aaron Brockovich, isn't it? And
that's it. Oh, yeah. He's, right.
Yeah, he looks like David Foster Wallace.
Yeah.
Like your friend, biker dude.
Your Friends and Neighbors is another really good one, too. Another LaBute film. So, anyway, but yeah, just this 2022 sampling of Aaron Eckhart I've gotten, I have not been very impressed, really. I think there's also, you know, tone issues here. Like you've got action versus suspense versus sci-fi versus romance, and it doesn't really come together. So yeah, I wrote it this way. It's Face Off meets North by Northwest meets X-Men, and it doesn't really totally come together, although last night's viewing, I had a little bit more appreciation for it.
Wowee. Now that's a mixed take. Niccolo.
Some people would say that Paycheck is an underrated masterpiece. Arguably the best film to come out of, you know, of John Woo's American era. I am indeed not one of those people.
This is like an American reality TV. You are not the father. I'm like, a kid's now fatherless, okay? Anyway.
Go back to the orphanage. Anyway, something that should go back to the orphanage is Paycheck. This is, it's not an abortion, but, you know, maybe it shouldn't have come to life. You know what I'm saying? It's
Roe
a movie
v. Wade
that
has been overturned, sorry. But, you know.
Well, you know, in some states. But
you have to carry it.
Jeez, poor John Woo. I feel so bad for him. Like, he understands the pain. It's one of those films that I saw it when I was going through my John Woo phase, and I was like, why do people hate this film? How can they hate it? Like, it's fun, it's enjoyable, it's not great, it's probably the weakest that is made in Hollywood. But you know, it's fun, it's alright. Rewatching it now, I still gave it a heart, but it's more to my, you know, love and appreciation of John Woo, and not because of the actual film itself, probably.
It's a broken heart, isn't it?
It's a broken heart. It's a broken arrow. You know, it's all connected. I don't know. It's not good. Just plain not good. Not a good film. And actually did end up reading the short story as well in preparation between yesterday and today. And I'm like, man, I don't even like the short story that much. It's an interesting concept that kind of goes nowhere. It is an interesting, it has themes that it wants to explore, except it's not enough, like there's not enough margin to actually explore anything interesting in here in terms of themes, in terms of thematics. Oh, the power of free will. Oh, you shouldn't know about your future because otherwise you're not going to be free of doing whatever you choose. Oh, the power of choice. Are we just, can you change your fate? It's like, yeah, it's like it's been done in 90,000 other movies and other books. Like, why? What makes you different, movie? Oh, it's kind of like a time travel film, except not. It's like someone knows about the future and they change everything just so that everything happens exactly the way it's supposed to be. All right, I guess. But then I'm watching it and it comes alive. For me, this genuinely comes alive only three times. Well, not like it comes alive when these three things are happening. There's action, there's Uma Thurman, and there's Paul Giamatti. When there's the three of them on screen, we're kind of like, yeah, you know, this is all right. This is fun.
So when there's three of them on screen in the end, and this is going to make an appearance, you're like, oh my goodness, this is great. Like the ending with the birdcage, and it's like, no, you're getting 33%. No, I'm getting 5. I'm just,
I'm peeking. I'm like, man, this is 5 stars.
And meanwhile, just Nicholas, just like Bill Pullman, just on his saxophone. Just
more like Cho Yun-Fat. We talked about that. In this case, it's Cho Yun-Fat sax.
Oh, it's tantric solo.
Yep. And it's like, I mean it. You know, the movie's over. This doesn't need to be. This doesn't need to be 2 hours long. I want to take everyone who watches Mission Impossible 2. And they say it's the worst movie that John Woo made in Hollywood. And I'm like, you know what? You can dislike it. But you cannot say it's the worst film he made in Hollywood because Paycheck exists. You know what? I'm removing the heart. I'm doing it now. I'm sorry, John.
I haven't even spoken it, by the way. Like, this is happening already.
Yakub, it's too many emotions here.
Because normally it's after 2 hours of me just telling you how great something is. You're like, this is full of shit. I'm removing the heart. The heart's coming off. I can't listen to this guy anymore. This is rubbish. Sorry.
I'm actually putting this at the bottom of his filmography, right before Once a Thief.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I like that one. Like, Blackjack is above this. The Dolph Lundgren TV pilot he made. Did you know about this?
Yeah.
No, but now I want to watch this.
Yeah, it's I've seen it. It's really hard to find. It's like a TV movie. It's a really low budget thing. He shot it in Toronto. And it has a similar production value. And same with, he did the pilot to John Woo's Once a Thief, which was a brief TV series in Canada too. And I think he directed the pilot, which bizarre. I think I also saw. Yeah. Yeah, is Blackjack,
is this a spaghetti western?
No. It's with, like, Dolph Lundgren, action, like, thriller.
Biker action film of some sort, I sort of forget.
I kind of like that one, actually. It's like a cheapo TV movie, but it's fun. It's better than Paycheck.
Like, you're saying this is hard to find?
No, not, it's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
There you go.
Oh, great. There we go.
Thank you, YouTube,
It was 10 or 15 years ago when I was shopping for it. So. Oh, nice.
I admire YouTube for this, by the way, because now it's on a hiatus because I'm trying to figure out how to organize my time. I was going through the sort of Wes Craven sort of filmography one by one, and he's made, like, I want to say, 3 TV movies. Summer of Fear, Invitation to Hell, and something else, and they're all on YouTube. And also made a porno, and you can find it on Pornhub.
I thought it was YouTube.
No, sorry. This one, he made, was it The Snake Woman? No. No, The Fireworks Woman. And no, it's not on Pornhub. It's on YouPorn. I actually had to go through a few websites to find it.
You know, porn sites are the unsung heroes of internet pirating. I've seen the Abel Ferrara movies that way. I've seen Gaspar Noé films that way.
Because, you know, like, no one really wants to give a job, like, at Sony or Disney. Just like, no, your job is going to be just trolling through porn sites to kind of, you know, flag for intellectual property. This is great. This is the true Wild West of the internet.
Pretty
shit
much.
You find in there.
Anyway, Yakub, tell us, why is Paycheck secretly a Western?
I can't see. I was trying to, like, how is this a Western? I'm watching this because I'm just like, I have this narrative in my head now. Like, how this must be a Western somehow. It's not really. It's more of a Hitchcock film. Right? But I, you know what? Like, I've seen this when I was in university. I think that was kind of my university days, and I forgot it completely. Like, I feel like Ben Affleck almost. I just had my memory erased, and just like now, it's just like, I think I've seen this before. I don't know. I did read the short story for this as well. And I'll have to say, like, this short story in general, like, all it is a great hook. It's a good concept, as in, like, look at this.
Yeah.
It's a good hook. And then the rest of it's kind of like, we can talk about that a little bit later on about what the film does to the story and then what essentially, like, Philip Dick's stories eventually are turned into, because I think his stories are usually expanded into something else because they're usually kind of these little nuggets of, like, here's a good concept and let's build the drama around it and put Uma Thurman in it.
I
didn't remember anything of it, so it was a brand new experience for me. And then it's not a good film, like, it really isn't. Like, 4 installments I had to 4 sittings it took me.
Pain and suffering.
4 30-minute sittings just to kind of just sit through this. It's not a good film. Like, it has its moments when it just kind of feels like, oh, actually it's gonna go somewhere nice, and then it really just fizzles out. And just in terms of just generics, as in, like, the performances are garbage. Like, I mean, Ben Affleck I have a real soft spot for. Like, I really like this guy. He's always very natural. He's always kind of just, especially in this era when he's kind of just on this sort of high after winning the Oscar, and he was getting these roles, and he was sort of had this sort of clout of working with Kevin Smith for a while. So he was this young sort of study, like, little actor, like, he was had this sort of boyish sort of bravado about him. I kind of like him about it. His smile, he's like, he looks like he's, you know, like, I don't know, like, he just had this sort of partial face paralysis like Stallone, but he kind of just ended up looking nice. Because he just smiles with one side of his face. And I don't know whether this is a gimmick on his behalf or he's really has a facial paralysis issue going on about it like Stallone. And so I don't know. I don't want to judge if he does have something just medically going on. Just, you know, you're pulling through, Ben. I really appreciate you. Anyway. But I really like him as a person, as an actor, and he's just a personality in this film that I kind of just enjoy looking at. Everybody else, I mean, not everybody else. Paul Giamatti is always good to look at, but Uma Thurman and Aaron Eckhart can really go and do one.
No, no, don't touch Uma.
I don't want to touch Uma. It's a hashtag Me Too. This is not the time to touch anybody.
I'm shaking my head here.
I mean, this is not a good performance for her. And there are scenes I pulled out for my top and bottom three list. And damn you! No, it's just so into the generic terms, like performances. It really is kind of just John Woo kind of just comes through like in these few select moments where you just have these moments of brief action, and then that's pretty much everything. And other than that, I'm amazed that we haven't, this is like, what, 30 minutes in, we're already in, and then no one's mentioned Minority Report.
Well, why?
I think the story came out after this, right? In the Minority Report novel, short story, whatever.
Short story, yes, but the film itself, it's clearly looks like it's just coming from the same sort of, tidal wave of let's start adapting Philip K. Dick and adapting them
totally,
in the same sort of style. And if you look at it, like when you say like, oh, it's all about fate, can we change fate? Oh no, I'm going to change what I'm doing so it can affect the future. You could literally just describe Minority Report.
That's honestly something I'll say a Hollywood to blame here, of course, but also I blame just Philip K. Dick. He wrote the same story twice, only the second time it was actually better.
What do you mean twice? Think about Total Recall, a guy who has his memory erased and he's trying to figure out what he's done in the past. Again, it's his paycheck. It's just with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's like, no, you're Hauser. No, you're me. No, you're me. I'm you.
He's just kind of expanding it in different ways. Yeah. Like, you know, he has this idea of predestination.
And then there's Next as well.
Yeah.
And he wrote
there's
Next.
A lot of identity. Next is him. And like identity issues and, you know, who are you if you can't remember?
So, I mean, I get it. I get it. Like everyone has their demons, you know, like the idea of just coming back to the same well, you know, I get it. And then it just so happens that in between, I want to say 2002 and 2006, there was this Minority Report, Imposter, and I think Next, right? There's at least four adaptations.
Next. Hmm?
Next was it 2007? Sorry. Yep. So in a span of few short years, this many Philip K. Dick adaptations kind of came out.
And Scanner Darkly.
And Scanner Darkly as well. Mm-hmm. Another one about identity, right? So it's all kind of just, I don't know. I look at this and I feel like, okay, this is again one of those where I think John Woo was just, I think, just hired to do this because the studio was seeing like, okay, well, there's this film coming through the pipeline called Minority Report, and the test screenings are amazing, and everyone keeps talking about it in town. We need to kind of jump on this because this is going to come and go, and we need to do this. So I feel this is like a cynical part of me wants to say this is part of the issue of the film, that it was just trying to kind of catch the sort of the bandwagon of let's adapt Philip K. Dick, or maybe in general, like let's adapt the sort of the 50s to 70s sci-fi, because this is again the same era as like I, Robot, I Am Legend.
Yeah.
So it's all like Richard Matheson, Isaac Asimov, Philip K. Dick, even William Gibson, you can just stretch all the way back to like Johnny Mnemonic almost. Like it feels like the sort of mid to late 90s, like there's a decade of trying to adapt sci-fi, and this kind of fits in there. And I feel like this is one of the more uninspired ones.
It's completely uninspired, I agree.
So that's kind of my take on this. It feels like this is sort of like a Me Too Minority Report, sort of like the sort of schlocky Minority Report that's kind of trying to just distinguish itself with a few sort of ideas, but in terms of like visuals, it almost even tries to kind of just looks like someone was being given notes about, look at Janusz Kamiński's cinematography and then just think about Spielberg, okay? It feels like that almost, like there are just these notes being left all around the set, and then John Woo was picking them up and saying, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do now, I suppose. And then, yeah. So I don't even know where to go with this. So let's just start with the sort of perennial question. Do you guys see John Woo in this film? That's just in general. Like, is this a film that you could see if I remove the credits? You could say, oh yeah, this is directed by John Woo. And why?
I would say so, because there's, well, you know, just visually, there's a lot of his usual style and gimmicks, especially during the action scenes. That's when you can see that. Even just the opening, there's this shot that's embedded in my brain of Ben Affleck walking down a hallway, and there's like this jittery cutting where it's like back and forth, and occasionally like there's an item being shown, and the actual shot becomes a still frame that's held for like a couple seconds. That makes me go, is my computer crashing? Something's wrong. It's just a movie. Just a movie. It's fine. There's John Woo, of course, but it's neutered John Woo, like more so than any of the other films. We've all enjoyed them to one extent or the other. We all like them. This one feels completely like neutered down, like the most work for hire job he's ever had.
Yeah, I think you can tell that John Woo's involved. Like you have some of the gunplay and the standoffs, and even with the context that we've explored about John Woo going to Hollywood and making Hollywood movies, like genre Hollywood movies, I can take that context and say, okay, yeah, that makes sense that he would want to do sort of an older style suspense or mistaken identity film. That sort of fits what I've come to see in Woo. You know, there's some of the action is all right. So yes, I can see Woo in here, but for the most part, it's kind of like watching a Woo movie, but not.
You had it ready to go, didn't you?
I got there.
Because, you know, I don't even know if I could say this. I mean, it feels like, okay, I'm watching this, and then this could have been, like, I'm watching the first half of this film, and this could have been directed by pretty much anybody, in my view. It kind of feels like it wants to be this sort of, like, faux Spielbergian in terms of visuals to me. The only time where you feel like, okay, well, is this John Woo directing this, is in this sort of the one big set piece that this film has, which is the sort of motorcycle chase, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, there's another one. There's this one, the Union Station shoot, although it kind of feels like it's just, is this the hospital in Hardboiled, right? Kind of just similarly lit. Anyway, but even so, I feel like the sort of the action set pieces and everything, it feels like they're a little bit in slow motion, as though like someone's just taking the momentum out of the man. Like, I don't know. I don't know if you guys felt the same way. Like everything feels like it's not as propulsive as it should have been. And I don't understand why. And so I have a thing like, do you guys feel something like that? That this film kind of just looks like it just, like it lacks octanes.
Yeah. Well,
completely.
Yeah. Like we mentioned it, I think, during the Wind Talkers conversation, that you can just feel that John Woo is done with Hollywood. Like, he's taking these jobs because he needs the money. He said, like, no good scripts are coming my way. And so it's either, like, keep turning down scripts, which means turning down money, or just, you know, biting the bullet and doing it.
Yeah. This feels very business production oriented. It doesn't really feel story oriented. This feels to me that after Wind Talkers, someone told John Woo in his office, mind you, you know, because it's more of a business venture, you should go do something more like Face Off again. He's like, oh, okay, maybe. And this came along and it seemed to be a good fit because I think he liked the ideas that were in the short story. But then when he got the script, I think Woo said, yeah, it's not great. You know, I'm happy with the sci-fi, but you know, this isn't great. Like, and to me, it feels like it's a good director overseeing a weak script. But he's not doing anything to really make it his own. He's just serviceably going through the script and shooting all the scenes, and it just doesn't come together well. So there's a little bit of, I don't want to say lost ambition, but there's a a little bit, there's less wind in his sails, I'll say, in terms of creative energies that's going into it. And we've talked about guys in the past, like filmmakers who aren't writers. And I think Wu sometimes, like, he's one of those guys that he's taking on other people's scripts. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to elevate a script, which is not that great. And this script is not that great. Even if you like the ideas that were put forth as sort of this Hitchcockian type of suspense, mistaken identity type of concept, you've got the action in there and you've got the sci-fi in there and you've got this duncey romance, and it just nothing really works. But I think Wu, like you said, Nick, he's taking the job because now he's in Hollywood and he has to pay the bills, or, you know, things are coming through his across his desk and he's not processing
helicopter payments.
Yeah, but he's processing this stuff not so much as a creative, it feels to me, but more so, yeah, this project could be okay. And it's sort of weak. Like there are so many problems with this script. Like, I think a lot of it goes to that. Wu does show up in here a little bit, but
I think too much power was given to the stars as well. Like, reading up the IMDb trivia, they say, like, Ben Affleck did this, and Ben Affleck said that, and he recommended that they do a shootout like that, and he said, hey, John Woo, why don't we do this thing? So it's like, it kind of is the bizarro version of Mission Impossible 2. It's everything Mission Impossible 2... It's everything that people say Mission Impossible 2 is, except it isn't. Like, they say Mission Impossible 2 is unwatchable, it's bad, the action sucks, the characters, the pacing, and the script, like, laughably bad, all of that. I think there's a self-awareness and energy in Mission Impossible 2 that makes it a fun Hitchcockian twist on, you know, it's meant to be a notorious homage by design, mm-hmm. by John Woo's admission. John Woo's
also
admission.
A Western.
I'm not gonna bait. Meanwhile, Paycheck is supposed to be the North by Northwest and it's a big stars and all of that, but nothing, like, I don't want to say that nothing works. I still think it's highly serviceable entertainment. Like, you're watching it and, like, at least I was watching it, like, it's, I'm not liking it as much as I did the first time around, but it's still all right. Like, it's 2 hours, way too long, but it still kind of moves at a decent or right pace, you know.
So what does work about it for you? Like, if I had to pull you up on specifics, when you say, like, it's serviceable, where's the service?
The hook. The hook is engaging enough where you do mm-hmm. want to see how every item is going to play a role in this story. The idea of just seeing how the machine works. The scoop is in the story. I don't remember if it's in the film as well.
No, there is no scoop. It's just a mirror.
Just a mirror.
The
stuff. Yeah.
They just see what's happening, because in the short story, the main hook is that he actively takes stuff from the future. The trinkets are from the future, right?
It's the ticket is from the day, and which is very clever. It's more interesting in a way, but whatever. So I like mm-hmm. the hook. I like this small sci-fi element. As I said, I do like Uma Thurman. I think she has a strong, like, screen presence. She's very watchable. She's very energetic. A bit of a manic pixie dream girl, except without all of the annoying personality. Some would say no personality, but still, you know, as far as love interests kind of take part in the action in these early 2000 films, I think she kind of elevates the material. And yeah, it's kind of it. And the action is all right. Like, it's when you have the shootouts and the chases, and there's the running, and there's the dodging, and there's the, oh, we're in the power, like, in the laboratory, and everything's blowing up. It's like, that's what's serviceable entertainment for me. Like, shit's blowing up, people are running, there's a lot of, like, we have to do this, otherwise there's the end of the world, which is ridiculous. I don't really care that much. I'm just kind of, like, sitting there just going, eh, it's all right. I've seen worse. Like, I'm not bored. Serviceable entertainment.
Yeah, and it's paced fine, you know, as a result of that. But honestly, I find all the action takes away from what I should be interested in, and probably what was interesting to Wu is it didn't work for me following, oh, how's he going to use the paperclip? How's he going to use that? How's he going to use the coin? I didn't really care or wasn't really too engaged with that. I was a little bit more interested in my viewing last night because, oh, this is what he was interested in. This is what Wu cared about. But I didn't catch too much of that when I watched it a couple of days ago. Like, to me, it's a constant distraction. And that, to me, says, like, that's that's the producers, that's Paramount saying like, this has to be action. This has to be, we've got our brand name star, Ben Affleck. He's hot. He's in the lead. And, you know, Uma, you know, she fits in there nicely. So, but to me, this doesn't really have a personality. Like, it has a bunch of moving parts that should work. And when you think of Hard Target is a pretty
masterpiece in comparison. Sorry.
Absolutely. But it's a fairly flimsy script. So what's the difference? And like, to me, it's the distraction.
Mullet is the difference.
The mullet is a big part of it, but performances too. Like, honestly, like, I like Ben Affleck. I think he's great. I think he's a really cool movie.
Give him a Cajun accent.
And a mullet. Forget the Cary Grant suit. That would improve things a lot. But you know what? If the villain were an interesting 90s villain, if you had Alan Rickman in there or Arnold Vosloo or, you know, someone with a Lance Henriksen, you
someone,
know,
and I anyone,
would, and I would suggest
Reddick.
Lance Reddick.
What's the,
yeah.
what's the guy who was a villain in Sudden Death? Always forget.
Oh, Powers Booth.
Powers Booth. Put Powers Booth in it. Jesus.
Yeah, and I would say too, take Colm Feore and Aaron Eckhart and combine them into one. Like neither
like
is
the thing style just.
Into one just, character.
Just,
this needed one more round through the team of writers. Like in my view, like I think Giamatti doesn't really work because he looks like he just came off the set of Friends or something. And
no, he looks like he came off the set of The Lady in the Water.
Yeah. but he's doing this weird comic thing. But yeah, like take Colm Feore and Aaron Eckhart and just combine those characters and. Give that role to Travolta to chew on, or Cage, or Defoe, or Rickman. Hell, Patrick Stewart, or someone with some gravitas that can take a 90s villain spirit into it. Like, I don't really care. Eckhart, he's not interesting. And Colm Feore is a great actor, but, you know, like he's not really given much here.
Aaron Eckhart is too young.
I'm not even sure if it's too young. I think Aaron Eckhart has the sort of energy of a 1950s leading man. Like it's and you give him a role of someone who's shady or someone who's supposed to be a straight up villain, it just does not work that well. Unless he's in a comic book environment, I think he does Harvey Dent relatively nice. Although he has a turn right in there, but you don't have to buy him like on face value. Like this is an evil dude, right? But it feels exactly like you think about, Jimmy Stewart. Like imagine Jimmy Stewart being a villain in a 1950s film. Like it's impossible. Like he's always the goody two shoes sort of. Like imagine now I'm blanking on this guy. North by Northwest. Who's this?
Oh, Cary Grant. No,
Cary Grant. Cary Grant. Yeah. Imagine him being a villain. Why am I forgetting Cary Grant's name? Like, I think this is 40 years from now when I have like raging dementia. I have no idea where I live. This is where it started. Like now.
Set a marker.
Do you remember things like this? No, obviously I don't. Anyway, but. I could feel like Aaron Eckhart just okay. Well, maybe it doesn't work. Maybe that's part of the issue. There is no dynamic between the good, but because like the story is painted in sort of very sort of stenciled sort of terms. Like there's this good guy and there's this bad guy. There's no sort of shades of gray. Meanwhile, in the short story, it's a little bit more sort of nuanced because the main character is a cynical ass. Like he's essentially doing this to, like this whole trip he's doing is to kind of just blackmail the guy. So it's a bit different, and then there is no love interest involved. And it's just and there's a twist with a woman. It's just and all in the span of 25 pages. It's ridiculous.
It's not a good time.
No. I mean the book. It can't hardly call it a book. It's a very short story. So I think on Wikipedia it's categorized as a novelette.
It's not even
it's shorter than a novella. Anyway, but what I was trying to say is. I don't, you know, when you say, oh, Ben Affleck wanted this, Ben Affleck wanted that, I'm just like, he specifically, there are these nodes in there. It's just Ben Affleck wanted to have a Mexican standoff because he always wanted to work with John Woo. And then this is what he wanted to do. It's like he's getting his birthday wish, right? Like he's
pretty much, yeah.
But then at this point, does the story call for this? not sure. I mean, it feels like, oh, look at this, there's a Mexican stuff. It almost feels like I'm in a John Woo theme park in a way.
Yeah, the action scenes are there just for the fun of it. They're not there to move the story forward, which is usually what John Woo does with action scenes. You know, like, but characters are being built.
Well, yeah, well, the action set pieces are supposed to be dramatic sort of vehicles in their own right. But in here, they don't really work. And then, like, you think, and I still think that some of them are kind of done in a way that just feel like everything's kind of slowed down. There's no kinetics about them. There's no mechanical propulsiveness to what's happening. Like, the guy's running away from a train and he's outrunning the train. Okay. You can clearly see, like, for some reason, the magic of cinema's gone. Because normally in the film, like, you know, this train's going 12 miles an hour and he's running away, and then they're cutting between and this just magically makes you think that he's actually running away from a speeding train. But in here you see the train in the same shot with Ben Affleck, and he's running, and he's kind of a bit of a hulking figure, so he's not a fast runner, you have to say, right? And the train's just moving away from you. So that means that he's speeding up. It's just,
but
no.
The train is breaking because there was an explosion. There's a reason behind that.
No, but it feels like it just lacks the balls of something that just should have these balls. Like you say, like when you say, this film's neutered. Exactly. It doesn't have balls. That's how I kind of feel about this, sort of like the Woo-isms in there. It just feels like he almost, like, literally just like, I've been thinking about these things, nothing's written up yet because I keep changing my mind, and now I'm standing with an idea for like 5 mini essays, and I'm thinking to myself, I should probably watch Mission Impossible 2 to just work it into the series and just do like 500-800 words sort of little essays, because I refuse to write a listicle. It's just about these sort of little metaphors, because in here it just feels like John Woo is just living vicariously through his characters, and he's essentially Ben Affleck who took a job and had his memory erased. Like, he was just like, fine, I'll do it. Like, you just do it. I'm doing it for the money. I don't care about the experience of doing this. All I care about is the money at the end, and just like, erase my memory. I don't care. And then it feels like when Ben Affleck just says, oh yeah, can I have a, you know, Mexican standoff, and he goes like, sure, why not, I don't give a shit. Like, it feels like he was just on the set going like, yeah, why not, like, I suppose we can have a motorcycle chase, I mean, yeah, sure, why not. And just like, there's no direction in this, for lack of a better word.
I wonder if there were time constraints on the production where he just, it, after his experience in Hollywood, he just said, well, okay, well, I'm not going to go out of my way anymore. So we've got these time constraints. I'm not going to go the extra mile like I used to. So I'm just going to try to finish on time, because, like, he would famously go over budget and over time in Hong Kong. So I think he just said, well, I'm not fighting these battles asking for more time to do this stuff right. You know, I've got my motorcycle scene in the middle, and Ben wants his standoff. We'll give him that, and everything else, I'll just sort of cover it.
It's written in the schedule. Especially because there's nothing to do. Like, there's a lot of just talking in here. Mm-hmm. Like, the action, the locations are very minimal. There are very few of them if you think about it. So, it's weirdly economical. Literally, the cast was the most expensive part of it.
That's true. It's like a $50 million budget. And
so 60, I think, right? 60 or 50? Something like that.
15 of something those like
are. 15 went to Affleck, right? And probably another 15 went to Woo.
Jesus. Yeah, Jonathan, so
just take Christian Slater and put him in the film, and this is already better.
Why?
And cheaper. Oh, because it's a better choice, you know. Christian Slater, we love him.
He was busy making like Alone in the Dark, right?
Oh no.
I actually made a couple notes myself. It's like, if I could recast this, which I would have loved to have done,
yes.
who would I have put in as Affleck? Like I say, I like the guy. I just don't, he's a blank slate here. He doesn't do much. And I think for that era, I wonder if I wrote down Christian Slater, Ed Norton, or Ewan McGregor would probably have been a little bit more interesting.
Oh,
Brad Pitt.
Very manic energy. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have a manic energy, Ben Affleck. Doesn't look particularly scared or afraid of what's happening.
He's supposed to be the wrong man. He's supposed to be the self. If John Woo's actively, like, he's on record saying, like, I'm trying to do a Hitchcock thriller, he's supposed to be Cary Grant. He's supposed to be Henry Fonda, right? He's supposed to be a wrong man, right? Who do you cast?
not Ben Affleck. Like, from the early 2000s, let me see, 2003, what other movies?
Like, in 2003, right? Like, we're casting this 20 years ago, right?
Yeah. So you still have to make it look like a 2003 movie. Like, I think Ben Affleck looks like Cary Grant. Like, he has that sort of movie star 1950s, 1960s type of look. Huh. And in a way, I find that's a little bit how he behaves in here.
Again, I don't want to state the obvious in here. You cast Tom Cruise.
Eric
Bana. He did it in Minority Report already. Exact same movie.
I got three names for you. Paul Bettany, Eric Bana, or Paul Walker.
Oh goodness.
Three very different films. Paul Walker. You know.
Oh yeah, one of them's going to be total garbage.
Such a meanie.
Okay, I've got another one for you. Ving Rhames, Michael Clark Duncan, and Sam Jackson. Just saying.
Wait, are you saying in the same movie?
No, as Ben Affleck. Sam Jackson would actually probably kill this.
Yeah.
Well, the vibe will be completely different.
It would be a different vibe of the film. And just, you know.
to me, I'm thinking, like, for a film like this, it goes back to, this film needs a Castor Troy or a Sheriff of Nottingham. Like, I need some
Alan Rickman instead of Alan Rickford. Yeah.
Yeah, like I need some conflict. I need someone to really embody, the villainy of this company. And it's the landscape of villains at the time is sort of interesting here once you get into the early 2000s, because, you know, we're getting away from, you know, the Alan Rickmans, and soon down the road, we're going to get the more naturalistic, terrorism inspired, real life inspired, grounded villains like Joker and Dark Knight, and, you know, the different villains in the Bond movies.
But he's supposed to be a face of a company, right? He's supposed to be the sleazeball who's posing as his friend, right?
I agree. I think that what makes this work is probably the 90s style villain. I'm just saying this is sort of a mixed bag where you've got Liam Neeson showing up different places as villains, and you know, we're a couple years away from more naturalistic style villains like Heath Ledger.
Gabriel Byrne?
Ooh. Hmm.
I like Gabriel Byrne.
Three words for you. Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah.
Like, at least he has characters on his written on, like, he has lines on his face, like he's lived a life, right?
Yeah.
Which is also a problem with Ben Affleck, I suppose, for Niccolo as well, because you're just like, I don't know, he doesn't look like, because like Ben Affleck now looks like a 50-year-old man, like he looks like a guy who's lived a life. So when he sits down and shuts up and just drinks a beer, you feel like he's thinking about shit he's done, right? so he just gets a lot done by the way he looks. And when you're like 29 and you look like you just, you know, like you just got out of bed with Jennifer Lopez, you're just like, like, what can you possibly teach me about life, Ben? You know? I kind of like him, but he's still a boy, right? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, so I think we're all in agreement that this villainy combo, this corporate villainy combo of Colm Feore and Aaron Eckhart doesn't really work. Like, to me, like, it's a huge hole in this movie that needs fixing. And, you know, it's a major demerit to the whole film because I just don't care. Like, I don't really understand, because the characters and the scenes with Eckhart are so weak, and I don't care, you know, why he's chasing him. It's so I'm a little bit lost watching this, and I shouldn't feel that way in what should be a straightforward action film.
Oh, I know. What you need is just cast Tom Cruise as him, as Ben Affleck's Ben Cruise. cast Max von Sydow as Aaron Eckhart. Has the character, is a corporate sort of face of because he looks like a CEO of a company. Like, this guy looks like a just douchebag middle manager, right?
Yeah.
Just, what do you know about this, running this company? You're a 35-year-old schlong. What do you know? Like, anyway, cast Colin Farrell as Paul Giamatti, and then just keep what's her face? No, Catherine Morris, because she's playing the other girl, and just. Keep her as and then just recast her as Uma Thurman, and then you've got yourself like a spin-off to Minority Report with just a different take on this on the same sort of story. Just you can just shoot it side by side. Just even just keep the same sets, because he's still like, you think like Tom Cruise like has this sort of like Ben Affleck like has this sort of memory erased at the beginning. He goes to his house and he watches a tape of Boston Red Sox because he just wants to find out if they lost or whatever. And it feels like Tom Cruise going to his house and watching his son run. Just, you're a good runner, Sean. You're gonna run, Sean. And he just gets high on clarity, and there's a cat shit on his bed or something like this. It's just, you know, it feels like it's essentially the same movie on a different set.
In Face Off, there's melodrama, and we talked about this, that works, and none of that works here. So I'm wondering, what's the formula? I think the villain is one thing, but I wonder if you have the protagonist, and if you have to have a love interest, have them play it straight. And no one seems to get that. Like, I guess Ben Affleck's sort of playing it straight, but Uma Thurman, I don't think the face touch. Well, Uma Thurman at one point is sitting beside an end table and she's caressing a picture of Ben Affleck, which is even weirder. Yeah, but she doesn't seem to understand what's going to make this film work, because she seems, you know, quirky and bold and a love interest and smart and a tag along. Like, she's just sort of a mess of a character in my mind. But, you know, if she was a character of substance, then you might have some of that melodrama that Woo likes, that he could latch onto. But none of that's in there. And Giamatti, like, he's just sort of horsing around in my mind. Like,
I don't even know what his remit is as a friend or as a coworker, like, because he both is just in charge of like I don't know, frying the guy's brain and then just coaching his stick fighting sessions.
Yeah,
he's in any shape, you know.
Also, in the weirdest gym of all time, where there's just, they just stack this of equipment in the corner and just put people on the bicycle and somewhere, or just in the chest fly machine, and then just in the corner while the majority of the gym is just these three sticks.
Ben Affleck. Dick whacking.
The sort of the whack-a-mole station. It's just 80% of the gym space is just whack-a-mole, and then everything's made of glass, and this is a recipe for a disaster, because he's just waving the stick around and nearly takes out Paul Giamatti in 1 second. it's ridiculous. Like, it feels like it's an art by committee again.
Yeah.
With all these glass sort of surfaces, it feels like it's trying to just be kind of sort of like this, like, post Minority Report sort of situation. Although at this point, I think they would have been in production, probably in different stages of production at the same time. I don't know, because it's only 1 year apart, so I'm not sure what the sort of turnover is for a Hollywood film at the turn of the century.
I think, like, since Wind Talkers was shot in the year 2000, I think this was probably shot in 2002, like when Minority Report was coming out.
So this feels like this feels like a tight production too.
Yeah, although I think, Niccolo, you mentioned this, like, when you're saying, because you alluded to this, and I just totally lost my train of thought because I have early onset dementia.
You need sleep.
No, when you say, like, you know, where, like, Ben Affleck wanted this, Ben Affleck wanted that, and then, like, when you say, when you're defending Mission Impossible 2, and I think to myself, Mission Impossible 2, he actually made a film that he wanted to make, and then he had it taken away from him, right, and re-edited.
A little bit, but I think it's still, like, the experience, especially because Ben Affleck is just coming to him saying, can we have the Mexican standoff? I really like your movies, Mr. Wu. But then in the other film, you have Tom Cruise just coming like, yeah, woo. I'll just climb the rock. Yeah, just in the distance, I'll do that. Yeah. Don't worry about that. I'm the producer. I can afford it. Yeah.
I mean, I think at this point, John was kind of like, can you really climb this rock? It's like, what's the safety guy gonna say? Well, if he doesn't say yes, we're gonna get a new safety guy, right?
I'm gonna buy one.
And this is John Woo talking about safety.
No, yeah, I remember that he was, like, very much afraid of looking at the monitors when they were shooting that scene of him just rock climbing in the opening, which is completely gratuitous, you know, never comes back in the story. It only comes back in Mission Impossible 6. But it's still, like, I feel like someone like Tom Cruise pushes Wu in terms of the action, in terms of the stunts. It's someone who's energetic, who's like an adrenaline junkie. And so he manages to pull off very exciting set pieces. And with people like Travolta and Cage, they love to act and they love to embody very colorful characters. And so that pushes him in terms of, you know, embracing the excessive melodrama that's always present in his movies and making it stronger and more emotionally resonant than it would have otherwise. In here, it's not a John Woo cast. Like, there's no one that he can bounce off to. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, who is he going to, like, and then it's like, okay, and even the script doesn't have action. Like, actually, like, the only instances of action are a bit forced. They are well done, but like Randy said, they don't move the story forward. They're boring. Like, they take away from everything else that's happening because it's a 15-minute bike chase. It's cool, but it doesn't lead to anything outside of it's a 15-minute bike chase.
You know, it would have helped if they actually, the characters were, or the story was structured around all parties wanting to get at the envelope. Like, this was, if this was like a proper MacGuffin. Because, like, at some point they lose the envelope and Uma Thurman goes like, I'm going to go back for the envelope. And she runs very slowly towards it as well.
And, and it didn't write it down. And she says something like,
and you don't
see
care.
You soon. Mm. And it's like, what, you're going into, like, there's cars coming, you're very, like, casually struck towards this envelope. It's the oddest, like, line delivery. It made me chuckle, but I was like, you're so calm about all this. Bless you. Just.
Oh, goodness.
I like what you said there, Niccolo, about the some of the other stars that he's worked with, I would say have a stronger capacity to work side by side, almost as peers with John Woo, to make the product better, to make the scene better, probably with Cage and Travolta, it's to make any scene better. What are we going to do to make any scene better? Cruise is probably, no, this is a me thing. And, you know, what are we going to do? Make this whole film. This whole film has to rock. What are we going to do, John? That's a total collaborative effort with Cruise as the producer. But even with Van Damme, like, Van Damme is sort of the star on set and he's probably working closer with John Woo, you know, to try to make Van Damme look good at least. And I wonder, like, I think you might be onto something, that probably Uma Thurman and Aaron Eckhart and Ben Affleck's sort of a semi big deal, but they show up on set. It's like, okay, John, what do you want me to do? And John has sort of tapped out.
Yeah. See, the dynamic is reversed because, like, I could expect that Ben Affleck would be like, well, Uncle John, can we have a Mexican standoff? Because they just think, oh, we want to do something that what you do, right? Whereas I think, like, Van Damme or Tom Cruise, especially Tom Cruise, would be pushing him, right? And it was like,
yeah.
I could imagine Van Damme going like, can I just do a split on a motorbike? And then just, can you do a split on a motorbike? Sure, I can. That's, why not? Or like Tom Cruise would be just, you know, like, I see a scene where we do a bit of free solo rock climbing. But why? Just because.
Yeah. And I think we can get the blade 3 millimeters from my eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it. No, let's do it. Audience won't love us if we don't go all in. You know, yes. And I don't think Ben Affleck and Aaron Eckhart, they're just not those guys, I don't think. You know, like,
I have to run away from the train. I have to be there. Trust me, John.
I could imagine, like, if it was Tom Cruise, would be just like, I want the train to be going at speed and I'm totally going to outrun it. And then safety guy's like, you can't do this. It's too dangerous. Okay, well Steve, you're fired. Let's get another safety guy in.
Like, it sounds like a joke, but he did the same. He actually did it not with a train, but with Mission Impossible 3, where there's a shot where he's almost run over by a car and it stops like this far away from his face. And then to get, like, the best stunt driver, what's not? It's like, it's so dangerous, you're gonna die if it hits you at that speed. So, you know.
Because he does have these crazy ideas, and he will just, this would be his idea in Mission Impossible, for instance. I always want, like, I think Matt Damon talks about it, they met at a party, and he just, Tom Cruise told him about this. Like, they always wanted to do the shot where he just jumps out of a window and he just runs down a building. and then apparently safety guy on Mission Impossible 4 was like, you can't do this. This is too dangerous. And then so he goes like, so I get a new safety guy. And then he told me it's fine.
It's
But this is a guy who pushes the boundary. Like, he goes and says, like, I want to do this. And then you're like, we need to figure out how to do this. Right. Or like when you hear McQuarrie talk about him and he says, like, you like the cameraman jumps out of a plane. And then Tom Cruise jumps out behind him and then just tries to catch up with him, and then he slows down just in the sort of the 30 centimeters of range, so he's in focus. Okay, I don't know how he does it, but that's Tom Cruise, right? So, you know, it's just I feel like this is lacking the sort of the balls on behalf of someone in the cast who would just
I don't think it would have been that big of an improvement, but probably honestly Matt Damon could have made this a better film. Which I'm far from the last, from the first person to sing his praises as an actor, but
what's wrong with Matt Damon?
I've never been a fan. Never been a fan of Matt Damon. I enjoy some of his movies, but I've never been like, yo, the new Matt Damon film is out. Like,
have you seen Stillwater, by the way?
No, I've not. I know you really like that film.
I really liked it.
I need to watch it, but...
He spreads his dramatic wings there. He's very good.
But yeah, at this time, I can actually see him doing maybe a better job. I don't know. But like, again, like... It's just at the roots of it. This is not the right film. Like, this was meant for Brett Ratner. It
does look like a Brett Ratner.
It really does feel like it. So, you know, it's like...
But it also feels like this is something that John Woo is basically like, well, I took this and the script was written by someone and he's just like, I think he was honestly burnt out by Hollywood at this point. He was just like, every single time I want to do something my way. Apart from Face Off, when he realized that he needs to do a Michael Bay, so they let it happen. I'm going to die on this hill, don't worry.
Great.
But like, he honestly, every single time he wants something done his way, they fight it. He has to fight for it, and he has to just spend energy just to fight for something that he knows is right, right? And then at some point, even like Wind Talkers, he wanted to have certain things a certain way, and they were like, no. We can't have this. This is an Oscar baity film. Like, how are we going to endear the octogenarians in the room? Like, you know. So it's, at this point, he's just like, fine. Just give me the money. Like, he's literally Ben Affleck. Just give me the money. I'm going to do what you asked me to do. And then at the end of the production, I want to see Aaron Eckhart telling me, you're done. You're done. You can go home now. And then, and then he just goes in there and just like, hey, where's my money? And then just... There's like a roll of toilet paper and like a novelty mug, a butt plug, and a bus ticket, and just that's your money. That's just like, figure it out.
At least there's a butt plug.
I just feel like this is a he honestly just was like, fine, I'll do it, and he was just like, well, Ben Affleck wants a Mexican standoff, I guess, fine, have a standoff. Producers say that a car chase would be good. Okay, fine, let's have a car chase. Can I have a bit of a Hitchcock film? It doesn't really fit there. I'll dress him the way you would dress in the 50s. Like, it just feels like it's just low effort filmmaking.
Agree.
However, I'm watching this, I'm just thinking, I really don't like it, right? I really don't like this film, and I'm just trying to see, okay, well, what's there to even talk about in this film? And I'm just thinking to myself, is this one of the sort of last sort of vestiges of this sort of mid-budget, by the way? $60 million, genre film, not tied to any franchise, not sort of, this is not a Star Wars, this is not a Disney production, this is not a Pixar film. It's still an adaptation of existing property, right? So it's still kind of just on a bandwagon of some sort, but it's like this mid-budget genre film. Is there a lure in this for you guys? Or is this just like, oh, is this a nostalgic sort of experience in any way? Or do you not give a shit?
Nah. Like, it's something that they kind of still do nowadays. I don't think this was the last time, like, there will be others in the future. Especially, I think sci-fi is just prime for that, because it's, unless it's a Star Wars, it's too expensive to make, but otherwise you cannot, let me rephrase that. Unless you're making a high-budget sci-fi epic like a Star Wars or an Avatar, it's still... usually a fairly expensive, you know, type of film to pull off. So it's always going to be around, you know, mid-budget levels. Mm-hmm. Like your Cloverfield Paradox or Moon and all the others like that. So,
well, Moon's kind of what? Like an almost small budget, like I don't know how many $1 million.
Probably like they saved on cast, I think.
Because Moon is what, like, I don't know, it's just one set, right?
Yeah, but still,
it cost like $5 million to make.
Oh, there you go. Not Moon then. But anyway, doesn't matter. There's no real appeal for me to that. I did grow up watching films from this era, mm-hmm. from like 2001, 2002 thrillers. But yeah, there's nothing for me. Like, I never go back to those types of films. Mm-hmm. I'm more of like action cinema of the time, like pure action I can get behind. But sci-fi, I think I've said this many times, like, I'm just not a sci-fi guy.
Yeah, this type of film could work for me, but I think it, Paycheck is emblematic of the era as well. This is a film that, you know, they were releasing, I think it was released on Christmas Day, and it was going up against Return of the King, if I'm not mistaken, in the box office. So no one held any type of prayer that this was going to make mega bucks, but still it had the $50 or $60 million investment, and studios were happy with that. This is a perfect example of one of those mid-size genre films that you're not going to see nowadays, because if you release it at Christmas, you know, you'll probably make a few bucks. So it made $110 million. That's still not making money, because, you know, it probably needs to make 2.5 or 3 times. But see, this was back in the era where 6 months later, there's going to be another chunk of money come in from video. And that's what's changed in the last 10 years or so, is you don't have the big chunk of money from video coming in. Because if you make, you know, a $40 million, Matt Damon was actually talking about this. I saw him recently. He was talking about what's the Candelabra film he did with Michael Douglas. Mm. That had like a $30 or $40 million budget. And by the time you pay the distributors and by the time you pay for the marketing, like, that has to make $100 million. So, you know, if you release it in theaters and it makes, you know, 40, 50, 60, well, in 6 months' time, you're going to have another huge chunk of cash come in from the video market. And he says, what's changed is you can't make those size films because they're just too risky, because you don't have the second wave of revenue coming in. So I think that Paycheck falls into that precisely as well, because, you know, it's, this is counter programming in Christmas 2003 season, mm-hmm. like, because everyone is going to see whatever the romantic comedy was and Return of the King. Like, I forget, but that tends to be the, you know, the mm-hmm. holiday feel good family stuff or Return of the King. That's what was on the docket that Christmas. And then there's a few other releases that end up being counter programming and are good for 30, 40, 50 million. And that's what this was. And I think they knew that, you know, very early days, which was another reason, like, that would send signals to Woo. Oh, we're looking for something to be, you know, Paramount's action film to go up against Return of the King. Like, he knows that no one really cares about it. It's just sort of a, you know, it's a genre piece and no one's really going to care. Like, he probably got those signals very early on. So why would he care? Maybe
that probably test audiences were already kind of just now on board with the film. So they were like, we can't really release it as the sort of, okay, well, as this is our guy to be like this, we're fighting for supremacy over the weekend with this film because we're clearly not going to win.
Right.
Right. But then, like, I think there's an allure in, for me, like, nostalgic allure in the sort of, when you say this is counter programming to Return of the King. A $60 million science fiction genre piece is a counter programming extravaganza, right? Mm-hmm. In today's market, a counter programming to Return of the King level of blockbuster would be a Jason Blum produced $2.5 million sort of tight 85 minute horror film.
Yeah.
Right.
Or an $8 million budgeted romance, you know.
Yeah.
Targeted like the Crawdads. Whatever the Crawdads yes. film is, something
when,
like that.
When the Crawdads sing or yeah. something like that. It's some yeah. some horseshit of that description. Like, there's the $60 million sort of counter-programming film does not exist, and it just maybe occasionally becomes the sort of the David Ayer-directed sort of Bright or the Gray Man or whatever, the sort of the event film of the tail end of the summer on Netflix, right? Because they still have the $60 million to dish out, and it's going to exist for exactly 1 week and a half, where people will just opine on it on Twitter and then it's just going to disappear. So you won't even find it when you scroll through Netflix. You'll have to go into the search and actively type Paycheck, right?
Yeah.
Like, so. You are to blame if you want to watch it.
Yeah, which, I mean, to me, this is a sadness, like massive sadness, right? When I have to just, when I can't I mean, this is a completely separate conversation to Paycheck, because like to me, like it's hard to even talk about Paycheck, because like we even like, I don't know. This is the sort of the outer shell of what this film is kind of more interesting, because it kind of just shows how the times were changing as well. And I don't know. And it feels like this type of movie nowadays is either doesn't get made, or it does get made and it's completely forgotten after. Like this is Infinity by Antoine Fuqua, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
Or some, is it Infinity or Infinitum? I don't know. Something like that. The Marky Mark Wahlberg sort of film that's on Prime.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Prime's a good example. Like this, like the Tom Clancy one without remorse. Oh, like without something remorse. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's sort of like what this is. Yeah, I agree. Mm.
But I'm glad it exists. No, I will say this. Like, yeah. I, it's not a good film. I don't want to watch it probably ever again. But I'm happy it exists for that reason, that it kind of shows how the times were different in a way. And even though it also still shows how much of a bandwagon could just, like little Stevie Spielberg could generate, just because he was such a massive sort of force of nature. I mean, it was a force of nature. It was just something to, a force to be reckoned with almost, right? It's just, yeah, it's ridiculous. And we haven't even touched the story as well. Like, it's just like, do you like the sci-fi element? Who gives a shit? Like, it's Minority right. Report, but without the balls.
Yeah, and with the Cerebro room from X-Men.
Like it's... Pretty much, yes.
Yeah. But I did appreciate watching it last night and seeing that, like, as sort of a support piece to our conversation on Wu that we've been having all month, to see what interests Wu is doing, like a Hitchcock film, the way that, you know, clearly he had an interest in shooting around Monument Valley or wherever they did Broken Arrow, because, you know, he has an interest in doing Hollywood movies. So, you know, that type of look at Paycheck, I satisfied me to a certain extent, you know, because you could see what he was doing and what he was trying just within this really clunky script. You could see what he was drawn to. And he was probably mandated and, you know, wouldn't have had Final Cut anyway, but he's probably told, look, you got to do all these action scenes because this is being sold as an action piece. And this is being sold as your next, you know, subsidiary Face-Off. That's what this is. So the action's got to be there. But what appealed to him, I would say, is, you know, the idea of the mystery of what do these pieces mean? What are these little knickknacks going to fit into that, you know, can get me out of trouble or whatever. Like that was the appeal, like the whole North by Northwest and the wrong man, mistaken identity. And like that type of tradition of film is where Wu was interested in.
I mean, I think this is, I mean, it is quite charming when you think about this, like what you're just saying, that John Woo made, I mean, it's charming and kind of tragic in the same vein to me, because John Woo came to Hollywood to make Hollywood films, I think, right? Like that's probably, because he made, like Hard Target is essentially, to me, this is like High Plains Drifter sort of situation. Not on Dangerous Ground. Yes, it is. The Most Dangerous Game, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's making a film like this, and then he's making a bona fide Western with a train set piece and everything, and then he's making a comic book movie. He's making a Batman film. Like Face Off is essentially Batman versus Joker, right? Then he's making a spy thriller, right? Mission Impossible 2. And then he's making, as you said, like John Wayne, 1950s, sort of propagandist, sort of... Oscar Beatty sort of, well, like Green Beret style, Guns of Navarone style World War II film, and now he's making a Hitchcock film, which is just, the sad part is that he was the only person in the room who wanted to make a film like this, right? Because everyone was like, Minority Report, we need to make a Minority Report, because I mean it's still a Hitchcock film in a way, with balls and with bald people in a rhubarb jelly or whatever. In actual fact, it's still filtered as well through probably the post-Matrix expectations of the genre cinema of the time, I suppose, to an extent, because, you know, you kind of have to. And it's just a tragedy because, like, he wanted to make Hollywood films, but then people he worked with, they wanted to work on a Hong Kong film without the trouble of going to Hong Kong, right? So he's like, can I have a Mexican standoff, John? And he was just like, fucking Jesus, fine.
Yeah. And see, probably the appeal in Hollywood of bringing John Woo over has to do with the independent movement in the 90s as well, where you have, you know, independent voices are starting to come back, like with, you know, Tarantino and others. And there's an appeal to bringing in fresh auteurs to the industry. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what brings Woo over. So Hollywood wants to bring Woo over and tell him, okay, do your really cool thing that everyone loves. But Wu didn't come over with his own scripts. So, you know, do that cool thing you do with this script. And, but Wu wanted to come over and he wanted to, I think we're seeing that he wanted to do Hollywood films almost more traditionally.
Like, I can do Hong Kong films in Hong Kong and I don't have a safety guy going like, you can't do this, John.
Yeah.
So it's just like, if I wanted to do a Hong Kong film, I would stay in Hong Kong. Jesus Christ, Bob, right? Whoever, or Joel Silver, or I don't know who was involved, yeah. Michael Douglas somewhere. But anyway, I just feel like this is almost condescending to the man when he's just like, do that thing you do, John, like jump for me, dance for me, monkey. Like, you know, this, it feels like, you know, just these people are trying to just, oh, we only know you from, I don't know. Like you see someone just, I don't know. Like you see someone who's a virtuoso on guitar, and it's just like you see how they shred and they do these sweep picking patterns, these great solo, and then it's like, do Wonderwall. Do you know Free Bird? I mean, just that's how I feel like thinking about this. And now I have a completely crystallized idea for what I want to write, and this needs to come out. I need to lock myself in there a room for like the whole long weekend and actually do this, because this is going to be the exasperated Hollywood cinema of John Woo series. This is it. This is happening. Anyway.
Yeah. But I think that's what's coming out in this film. Like he's just every time he might meet resistance here, he's fine. Well, why don't we just do it the way that it says in the script, which is a little bit weak anyway, but no one will resist me if I just do it the way it says in the script, you know?
Like, it feels like this is exactly what happened. It's just, I don't know. Anyway, I have a feeling that it's a good moment to kind of just, you know, transition to our top threes and bottom threes after a brief sort of woo or boo on this. Nick, is it still a boo? Did you remove the heart?
I did remove the heart right in the opening. It's a boo. It's a boo. Which feels bad. Feels bad. I still think, as I said before, it is so serviceable entertainment. It is the type of movie that if you, for some reason, have nothing else to watch, or if you just don't want to watch anything that takes like a lot of brain work, or just a bit tired, but it's like, I want to go to sleep, 2 hours, I kind of like the cast usually, you know, I've heard of John Woo, let me just check out Paycheck. I think you're going to leave, you know, entertained enough, maybe even with a smile on your face after that lovely final scene.
This is weirdly positive, by the way. Just almost too positive.
You know, half glass full kind of person. That's who I am.
Jesus.
It's fun. It's all right. Again, I did give it a heart even the second time around. I did remove the heart by now, you know, but it's still, it's not horrible. It's not unwatchable. It's not like excessively bad, but it is easily a boo, easily the only one of his American films that I don't really like, that I don't really want to rewatch. And a shame. A true shame that it ended up like this. It would go on to just, you know, have a bit of an hiatus, make a short film for All the Invisible Children, which is an alright anthology. Saw it when I was little. And then it just made a double, like two propaganda Chinese films, because Hong Kong cinema was dead by that time. By the time it went back there. So, you know, it's a bit sad.
It's a fun fact, by the way. Apparently they've passed a few laws early this year, right? About potentially removing from circulation films that may not be towing the party line, as in like they may not be celebrating Chinese values enough. And then there was this sort of fear that sort of the Shaw Brothers films and maybe early John Woo films and Ringo Lam films will be just going and disappearing.
Yeah, I have a friend who's Chinese and he went back to China and we keep in touch, and he says that, you know, cinemas are basically just showing propaganda movies. Ugh. Like by bullying and all the others. Yeah. So it's like, isn't the China the best country in the world? Yay, everything else sucks.
I mean, you kind of get this in America, right, as well, like with this American Sniper is a film, right? Or
but I think too, like, aren't a lot of the Hong Kong filmmakers from the 90s and 2000s, haven't they sort of moved their operations to Beijing? Like guys like Wong Kar-wai and Chen Kai-gi. I think, like, that's what I understood, that they're more supported, and they've been brought to make films for the for the country.
I think they have to, right? Because otherwise you're not going to get money. Because like, you show someone a script, like, I want to finance this, and they'll be like to me the equivalence to me is Polish cinema of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, right? Where you'd have to like, if you want a movie finance, you have to kind of show the script to someone, and then this someone would just be looking at it with a fine tooth comb for irregularities, if you know, like, it can't be overtly anti-communist, it can't be this, it can't be that. So people were, I suppose, people, because Polish filmmakers were like that they would just, but you're not the boss of me. So they will be smuggling these things in like deeper meanings, and just they would try to kind of just hide these things and make them a little bit more symbolic, because otherwise films wouldn't get made. So maybe that's the issue, that the people who just, at some point, they just give up and say, fine, I'm going to make a fucking sandal epic for you about the Great Wall or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just sad. But anyway, you kind of, Nicola, you kind of sounded a little bit like a John Woo shill in this of like, oh, you know, it's, I like this. It's like me going into a new Tarantino film. It's just, how am I going to rationalize the 5-star rating that I'm clearly going to give this movie, right?
Well, you know, in the first episode, you said I was a poser with my love of John Woo. So, you know, the circle is closed now. From poser to shill.
Because you're just like, oh.
I just feel bad. I don't want to say these things, but I want to be honest as well.
I know you love him. I know you love him. Just embrace it. Just say you love Paycheck. You know?
I'll just say I wish we were talking about Mission Impossible 2 again.
Well, I was watching this and I was thinking this myself as well. Just, I could have been watching Mission Impossible 2. Anyway, Randy, what is your final take?
When I watched this the second time this week through the lens of this being a suspense film, I had a little bit of affection for the idea of what Woo was trying to do and what maybe interested him, but still at the end of the day, this has got to be a boo. There are just too many elements that don't work, and it goes down to cast, it goes down to the ineffective mini dramas, it goes down to how the roles are written. Like, it's just weak stuff for, you know, that Thurman is given, that Giamatti is given. It's just sort of a mess through and through, and you've got a combo of things that sort of in the boardroom might look appealing. Oh, sci-fi and action and suspense. But you know, when it all plays out and you don't have a chemistry between the protagonist and his love interest, the protagonist and the antagonist, you know, there's just nothing really to care for in this. So it's really, really hard to get into it. And the only thing that I'm left with that is positive in a way is it's briskly paced, and you know, there's some good action moments along the way, but really it's not enough. Like, yeah,
I'm not even sure if it's briskly paced. It's when it is, I think it is, but most of the time it's just like, it's like, Nicola, you were just like, oh, you know, like, if you want something, like, if you're going to bed, put something on, like, yeah, get it, exactly, put something on. If you suffer from insomnia, just put it on your phone, and then guaranteed 10 minutes in, the phone's gonna slap you on the face, just because you're gonna just drift off. That's what happened to me, by the way.
I didn't have that issue. Like, it moves from one thing to another, and the cafe is going to get shut up. And
yeah. Four installments it took me to watch this.
It could still be shorter. There's no question. Like, you could take a half hour off this, and you know, I'd be a hell of a lot happier. But
start with the stick training session. Just take this out. The whole gym session. The stick whacking session could go. Like, there's so many things that could go. And then when you think to yourself, like, if there's so many superfluous scenes, they're just for no good reason there. It just feels like it's a mess. And then, like, I like messes, but this is a mess that's not entertaining and feels like it doesn't have the heart that would normally just keep this thing beating and keep it alive. I just, no, it's a boo. It's the biggest boo of all boos in, when it comes to John Woo. It's a John Boo film, you know?
A boo-goost.
It's a boo-goost. I mean, it saddens me that it's just like, well, because we're doing this chronologically, and I knew this was going to happen, right? Because like Paycheck is one of those that is really hardest to love, and I really tried. Like, I really tried to find something, and I can't. I can't find something. I even find something to love in Face Off, okay?
It's not Jacob. Remember, you owe us another viewing of that in the next year or two.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know. I know. It's on, it's in my calendar. I don't like this film. And at this point, it's just, it's not even that it's offensively bad. It's just so mediocre that it just hurts, you know? It's just bland, 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 bland. Bleh. Needs salt. Like... Like, as you said, like it doesn't have a defined villain. The protagonist is kind of meh. Everything's kind of meh. And then Uma Thurman has her sort of like outbursts of just like, maybe the Academy's watching. Just
good Lord, I don't think she's possibly be thinking that here.
I don't know. She just feels like she has these sort of like these moments. Where like, you're tearing me apart. Like, just really. It's just really. Anyway, I think it's a good time to just see if we can find three good things about it. So how about our top threes? Nicola, super, you start doable. First, because you're the August boy. Let's start with you first. How about that?
Okay, I got number three. It happens twice, maybe more. I don't know. I kind of lost track of that. But there's a couple fun Texas switches during the chases. And for people who don't know, a Texas switch is when you have a character or an object or a vehicle, whatever, entering the frame and then leaving the frame. And as soon as that person is not in the frame anymore, it's switched with something else or someone else. And there's a couple instances in here where it's clear that Ben Affleck just kind of goes off screen and the camera pans and is like 20 meters further away and is like way more agile. That was like, that's a
switch. You can outrun right a train. Come on.
Of course. There you go. I'm sorry, Ben. I didn't mean to belittle you. Number two, he makes a makeshift flamethrower with a gas spray and a can and like uses it to confuse two people and they shoot each other. It's fun. It's all right. It's a cool move. Number one, it is during the car chase, bike chase. And it's when Uma Thurman and Ben Affleck are running away. And this is a double whammy, actually. Because there's a pipe from the ceiling in this kind of like sewer conduct road, whatever. Split. It splits the police car roof in half, which is awesome. And mm-hmm. Uma Thurman, just to kind of be done with the policeman, just takes her helmet and just throws it in his face and that knocks him out. That's actually
a good moment.
That's a good moment, yeah. So that's my number threes. I found them. I also wrote down training with Jamati screaming, but you know, let's say honorable mention.
She's training with Jamati, just randomly avoiding brain injury.
Hey, I kind of wish I could go to the gym and have my own Paul Jamati just screaming. Like,
it's basically a scene from Cinderella Man.
The unofficial sequel.
This is real reenactment of the broken arrow scene. Just like, come on, don't try and hit me and hit me, you know. Randy?
Yeah, true. All right, so I'll give a mini woo to an acting line delivery. I like Colm Feore as an actor. I really do.
I was eating pie. Is that the one?
That's it. It's a great line. It's one of the best deliveries in the film. Colm Feore is otherwise poorly used here. Although it's worth noting, so he was in Face Off as well, right? He was the doctor who... the faces, yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the one main thing I can say positive about one of the performances that I sort of liked. All right. I liked the cafe scene, the Cafe Michelle scene where Uma goes, but Eckhart and his team intercept this information and they send someone named Rachel? Is Uma Thurman. Yeah. They send someone undercover. I forget the actress's name. Her last name is Milicevic. Anyway, so I sort of like this sequence. It starts with a nice little moment where Affleck is sitting there and he lifts the lid off of the coffee cream lid and sees the reflection. And it's sort of a nice little cinematic moment. And then Eckhart is giving information to Miljevic's earpiece. And then you cut right to his lips, to her earpiece. It's sort of a nice little piece. And then there's a split screen in there. And I wonder if that's a nod to De Palma. There was a split screen. So I wonder if in some way that's a nod to De Palma, because I think the scene in Mission Impossible, the original, where Cruise sort of descends, in a way, I wonder if that's a nod to Woo's Once a Thief, because there's a scene in Once a Thief like that. So, and I think that Woo will sort of give a nod to filmmakers he likes who have sort of given him a bit of a pat on the back and a reference.
Gives them a little bit of a tug and pull, because, you know, like, maybe, oh, you jerked me off in the 90s. Now I'm going to just return the favor, you know?
I'm going to do it here in 2003. Anyway, maybe not. But the whole scene is fairly good. I do like this.
It's called a reach around.
It's called, yes. Two-person circle jerk.
No, give it in, Curtis, you have a reach around. Like, I feel like Lee Ermey.
So we talked about it sort of in jest throughout. Affleck pining for, can Mr. Woo, can we please do a standoff like you do?
I'm pretty sure he calls him Uncle John. I kept telling you he calls him Uncle John.
Uncle John? Anyway, the standoffs in here, especially the one between Affleck and Fiore, it looks good. It's cinematically cool. I like it. And my number one is the motorcycle chase. And a couple moments within it, different ones that Nick mentioned. I like, there's a slow-mo shot of Uma sliding on the gravel. Very cinematic. It looks good. It looks very Woo. And the gravel is very dynamic, because the other moment in that, I like when Affleck sort of turns around and slides the bike and spits up a bunch of gravel. Also looks fairly cool. Good little moment. Good little Woo signature.
Okay, so my top three Woos. Special shout out to the guy who hits the ground, shoots, and then recoils back. Scene, I think, gets a stick to the face and he just shoots to the ground and just jumps the other direction. Just great.
Boing.
I want to say the Union Station shootout with Descartes and Paul Giamatti. I think that's a good scene. I like this sort of, because it kind of feels a little bit more sort of like there are people around. It kind of looks like there's stuff happening. Kind of liked it.
Yeah.
I'm going to substitute out the motorcycle chase, because it's going to be a total echo chamber in here. So I'm going to take this out, and then I'm going to insert when Fiore just looks into his future and he sees him.
blowing up
and he turns around, he blows up, and it looks like, I'm not sure if this is CG, then great, but if not, this is like someone got a suntan out of this. it's just I don't know, it's a very satisfying explosion for me. But the best thing about the film for me is something that we haven't talked about at all. One of the FBI agents, Joe Morton, I really like this guy. He's just, he barely says anything, but he has this sort of, I don't know, he's one of those guys that just doesn't really talk that much, but he just has this sort of presence, especially at the end. He just chews gum and he's just very sort of casual. I just like the way he moves. I don't know. I'm really trying to find some Woos in here. Okay.
Yeah, we didn't say Michael C. Hall was in this as well.
C. Hall. Debut. Yeah. Was it his debut?
Film debut. Yeah,
because right, he was already on Dexter at the time, wasn't he?
Nope.
No, but he
Dexter
was in
Dexter, like 2005.
Six Feet Under was one of the.
Oh, right, yes, of course. He was shows, in 6 Feet Under.
And that was probably around this time. I didn't like him in this. I'm not a big Michael C. Hall fan.
Well,
but
we haven't mentioned Michael C. Hall, but I'm going to mention him in a few seconds. So now it's time for bottom. So give me your boos.
Boo boo time.
Did you say boob time?
boo boo, honey boo boo. Mini ugly. There's a newspaper goof where they say Nexium announces its answer to IRC's living display, but it is written it is like it. It's not it's possessed, like no, it's English. It's not that hard. double check. Ah. Proofread.
It's like the Tyrannosaurus Rex being misspelled in Jurassic Park or whatever. Like someone fucked up.
Yes. And I usually don't know.
And they probably underpaid PAs. Like, you probably. Just write this document, you idiot.
So we need it in 5 minutes for the scene.
I'm not being paid enough for this $5 an hour.
Number three. The hologram display technology looks god awful. I don't want that. No one would want that. Number two. There's Ben Affleck uses a magazine to create an explosion, like by throwing it on train tracks, active train tracks, and just kind of blows up in Colin Farrell's face. And I was like,
it's the future.
I don't know about that, Chief. You're going to blow up from all the bullets. But number one, I really, really couldn't stand the robot arm. That's the goofiest, stupidest, early 2000 thing to have. It's the robot arm that you can control. It does all the cool moves and it helps out in the final climax.
It's the Chekhov's robot arm as well. Fucking gross.
It was not good. Oh, also, a second mini ugly. There's the shot of, the slow motion shot of Ben Affleck dying, falling to his death. And it's clearly not Ben Affleck. It's either someone with his mask on.
Jesus as well, just...
Which can be fine, but they use that elongated moment three or four times. And you see that over and over. If, slip it in once, I can be fine. Yeah.
I mean, he was almost this close to doing Nicolas Cage in Next when he's just the bullet comes in and he goes
That's not long an hair
and everything. It's just great. Ben Affleck needed long hair for this film. I just want to say, this would have changed the game for me.
John Woo, Nicholas, the Tom Cruise hair. Randy. Yeah.
It needed an overhaul. More than the hair. Okay. Mini Ugly. The CGI nuclear explosion that devastates a city. That was a trash shot. Certainly doesn't age well. Looks bad.
Terminator made it.
Yeah.
There's no fate but what we make, okay?
This came from LA, had it as well.
Looks brutal.
Tastes not good.
All right. Number
Absolutely
three.
Barbaric. That's what it is. Sorry.
Number three, the banter, the one-liners, the improv, which all come together in this ridiculous denouement where Uma Thurman and Paul Giamatti and Ben Affleck have decided to basically work at some community greenhouse or something. Just
the community greenhouse is essentially a set from Minority Report. They also had a greenhouse. The woman had a greenhouse in it.
Yeah, and I think probably Ben Affleck said, I should use this in the town.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a set sort of like that there too. Anyway, and so just the banter between these characters is just so painful. Number two, the wind room or, the little mini science lab biosphere, wherever it is that...
The wind room. This is how I refer to my toilet.
This place where
my fiber intake is top notch recently, and it's just every day is a tuba solos. Just bum, 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 bum. Anyway,
my wind room is Uma Thurman's place of work, and this is just there's this brutal scene where we're introduced to this room, and we're going to end up on the catwalks later. But there's all these really painfully obvious foreshadowing moments where we see the robot arm and we see this weird dynamic with the staff starts laughing at Ben Affleck whenever Uma Thurman changes the climate buttons. It's just such an awkward scene. Hated that. And number one, honestly, it's the casting. Affleck and Thurman have no chemistry whatsoever. Affleck and Eckhart, no chemistry whatsoever. Eckhart himself, he needs to be a 90s villain, I feel, in a film like this, but he's not over the top dynamic evil. That would have really helped things. Giamatti, like I say, I feel like he's coming off the set of Seinfeld or something. Like there's this hopeless mugging that he's doing.
Hi, everyone.
Like, yeah, like he feels like Macaulay Culkin.
He walks in and he just gives this pause like he's in a sitcom as in like, hi, everyone. And there's applause and woo, woo, woo from the audience reel.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Kramer just came into the room.
Like he has to just, you know, wait until these people fucking calm down.
Yeah, who would be the two or three extras that they have riding the bikes in the back?
John
Woo
is a massive
room.
Paul Giamatti fan, so every time he showed up, he was giving the standing O in there. And he's like, okay.
Great job,
someone
Paul.
Like giving him joy.
Great job, Paul. Yeah.
Is that all?
That's it.
Okay.
I restrained myself and kept it to three or four.
Okay. Mini ugly. The agent that leans against the desk and in the beginning, it's like he's Paul Giamatti is trying not to fry the guy's brain, and he just leans against the desk and touches the PC and all of a sudden just disrupts something. It's like, you're really frying, like, is he touched the computer? Like, the fuck?
How's that affecting
this
brain
working?
Temperature?
Yeah. How's this working? So that's just the mini one. I mean, there's so many other mini ones, but then okay, well, another one, let's just say. Okay, well, no, this is just going to be number three. The FBI interrogation in a rotating chair. The guy's spinning this whole time and they're talking to him. Like they're just giving him information he doesn't need to hear. And just Michael C. Hall is just really hamming it up. I mean, I don't mind him, but Jesus Christ, this is just such a rough scene.
Power of confusion.
No, it's just, it feels like he's still kind of just like, maybe I'll just do a scene like Michael Bay would shoot it. Let's just do it that way. Just, because it feels like it's just like it needs Michael Clark Duncan in a mankini, like on a table somewhere, or Ving Rhames, I don't know, someone, and Bruce Willis just like, you're always being a dick, or just, I don't know. I love you, Harry. And what was I? I don't know. I know, another mini ugly, and this is something that I really felt passionate about, but I didn't really quite know how to put it because it's a general thing. Like, John Powell music can just go and do one. Like, I'm not even joking in here. It's just like, you see this stuff, these moments, and it just feels like this, just take out your bingo cards. It feels like a South Park set level of satire, like Team America, just like these sort of these strings and these, like, it feels like this is like James Horner for a parody.
I felt that at the end there,
yes.
The finale.
Oh goodness! Yeah. Oh, kill me now! Just like this slow down and I'm just fucking kill me. Just Jesus.
I don't like the score in this one. I think it's good. It's a good score.
So
it's good
another one, and this okay well. This is a big one, but I'm going to preface this because I had to fit her somewhere. Just Uma Thurman, just in general, also annoys the living shit out of me in this film. Especially, and this is the moment I have, in the ending where Giamatti, like you, Randy, you just, like you did it, you stole this from my, under my nose. I almost kept it. When Giamatti shows up and they bicker over the ticket, and then, but then before Uma Thurman goes like, "I feel like starting a startup company," and what's gonna be your business? I'm gonna be changing the world.
But it's a reference to a previous part of the movie because, like, that's what he was talking about with Aaron Eckhart when they were younger. Mm-hmm. It's like, do you remember changing the world?
Yeah,
oh, saving
yeah,
the world.
It's
good screenwriting. It's coming back. It's like poetry.
And they laugh. They're just like, this is like the opening to Commando where just Arnie's just feeding a fawn and they're just having ice cream. And he has ice cream on his nose and he goes, and they all have this conversation. Like, now you're getting 33%. Now you're getting 5. Ah, you know, we're going to be rich. And then he takes out this lottery ticket and should be covered in bird shit. And then, true. By the way, did you notice the nod to Hardball with a bird cage as well?
Yeah.
Same bird cage. But then just in this film, just then just the screen reduces to this little box, and I'm just like, oh, are we going to a gag reel now? And they're just like, and they're just like, it's literally a sitcom, and they're just, Paul Giamatti is just like, and I'm, and just like, oh, is this the gag reel? No, the whole film is a gag reel.
This different type of gag.
And is it just me, or is it, it feels to me that anytime that Ben Affleck gets a direction from his director that says be playful, then when his line is really, really, like, it seems like that's his go-to, really.
Yeah, with
he's got the weird enunciation. Yeah,
like he's doing like I'm a happy facelift Stallone. Just oh. So I'm so sorry, Sly. I love Sly. Sly is one of my favorite people, but Jesus Christ, like Ben Affleck at this sort of, I'm a boyish charm. I've got, like, you know, like I do this, girls wet their pants. You know, like, I didn't wet anything.
Oh, did you see him carry that soil around, though? Yeah, it was such a great ending.
Yeah,
in the
room, just lifted wholesale from, yeah, Minority Report. It feels like they just finished, like they wrapped Minority Report and the lights went off, and then is Minority Report? That's a Universal film, right?
Maybe I'd say so.
I sort of forget. I think it makes sense, but I sort of forget.
It's a Fox. Anyway. Okay. Because it's just behind Foxy. Me. Yeah, it's just, oh goodness, like it feels like they just shot it on the same set. It just, the lights went off, everyone's like, that's a wrap, boys, and Tom Cruise is like, I'm gonna go and jump on the sofa or whatever, and then, or just, I don't know, jump down the building, I don't know, and then just John Woo with his crew just goes like, okay, our turn, boys, just move into this fucking garden, let's just put Ben in there, just be charming, and Ben's like, really? And Paul Giamatti's like, I'm back, bitch. It's just, I just finished filming with M. Night Shyamalan, and it's just, you know, I need a change of scenery. Oh, I've got lines I can actually say. Great. Anyway. And I really like Lady in the Water. You know, it's a difficult one to like, but you can get, yeah, there.
It is.
It's easier like to like than this.
Well, I don't know about that.
Because, you know, like, this film doesn't have Snarf or whatever the hell the other film had. Schnarf. Yeah. Schwarf. I don't know.
Schnaps?
Schnaps?
Snarfs or something.
Snarfs. And then, I don't know. Anyway, Paycheck, if you really want to fall asleep to this, it's on Netflix in the UK, and I think on Showtime in the US. Almost burped. Anyway, you can also acquire it in physical media if you really so choose, and then you'll take it off the shelf, you'll put it in your Blu-ray player, and then you're gonna fall asleep in a very uncomfortable position on your sofa, unless you're gonna watch this in bed, which I don't advise, watching TV in bed. It's not good for you. Where was I? Anyway, we did it. That's it. August has come to an end. We've collected our paychecks. Where can we find your all of your stuff? Let's give us a quick plug. Randy, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Randy Burrows. You can find me on Letterboxd at Bratch7. And you can find some of my articles on clapperltd.co.uk.
Awesome. Nicolo.
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at NickyGrow97, and there you can follow my journey to the Venice Film Festival, to which I'm by the time this episode drops, I've been there for like 4 days. So, you know, go there, check out all of my thoughts, all of my tweets, together with the good Ewan Gledow, friend of the podcast. And also check out the Death of Adaptation podcast, speaking of which, new episode just dropped on Beauty and the Beast. And if all goes well, we will make a special episode on the 11th, just about Blonde.
Ooh, nice, nice, ooh-hoo, nice. So, you know, stay, yeah, tuned for Nick's hot takes about Venice Film Festival and the films there. Because if I remember correctly, the lineup is absolutely stacked.
There'll be big names this year. So I would say too many.
I wish I was there. Oh, such a good lineup for this film. Ah,
Next year. I know you really want to watch the Nicholas Winding Refn 5-hour TV show.
No, actually don't. No. Anyway, you can find me, Talk About Film, on Twitter, Jakub Flash on Letterboxd. And I've actually started updating my Letterboxd. I've logged quite a few. Yes.
Makes me so happy.
I have this weekend, I still have like 60 to do.
Jesus.
So maybe you won't be leaving it in your will to your daughter.
No, she'll be like, what's that? And then it's like in my will, it's like, you're supposed to give 5 stars to the following films. and then 3 stars to Face Off, just to spite these people. anyway, so Jakub Flash, Letterboxd, that Talk About Film, Twitter, flashandfilm.com. Hopefully this time, and this is happening. I'm gonna write this down because this is now amazing. I think I have this secured in my head. This is happening. I just need to force myself to do this. Anyway, flashandfilm.com, sometimes Clapper. Follow the show at Uncut Gems Pod everywhere, which is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. And I think TikToks are gonna come back because the reels are making a comeback.
TikToks.
I don't know. Maybe you should actually cancel TikTok because apparently it just spies on you. It's not very good for business. Anyway.
Thank you, China.
Well, so yeah,
for giving us John Woo.
Yeah, exactly. Although, he did cash in his paycheck. And just anyway, where was I? You can find us there. You can also just go on uncutgemspodcast.com, which is our website, to kind of browse through all the previous shizzle we did, which also includes bonus episodes that we put on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/uncutgemspod, where $3 a month worth of support will buy you access to bonus tie-in shows, mini retrospectives, and our David Lynch marathon that's ongoing and it's entering its 9th month soon. So it's ready to drop, baby. And that's about it. Now get in touch uncutgemspod@gmail.com or uncutgemspodcast.com/contact if you disagree or agree with our takes, or you want to kind of just share your takes on Paycheck or John Woo in general, or anything for that matter. Like, we really appreciate when people just get in touch, because then they end up being friendly with us and then they end up being hosts on the show. This is how Randy got in here. I don't know, just get in touch. We love speaking to people. And that's about it. The August has come to an end. So stay tuned for next week, because next week is the big one. So in collaboration with Classics at City Cinema in Charlottetown in Canada, we're going to be talking about Freebie and the Bean. And this is also going to be on the same day as the episode drops. It's going to be screened in Charlottetown and Randy's going to be there to host. So go there and watch, and then tune into the episode, or just tune into the episode and then buy yourself a DVD or a Blu-ray and watch the film with us, and then celebrate the memory of James Caan.
And maybe you'll get a t-shirt.
Or a sticker or something. I don't know what the plan is. Randy's keep playing his chest close to his cards.
It's t-shirts, baby.
And yeah, that's about it. So hope to see you there at the Charlottetown Cinema. And see you next week. Bye-bye.